case for argument is Liu versus Mund. Mr. Dickerson.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Frank Dickerson acting as amicus curiae in favor of partial reversal. The core issue in this case is whether a common law duty to mitigate should be imposed on aliens who are a beneficiary of an affidavit of support under federal immigration law.
So here's the dilemma I have about this case. So if you have a duty to mitigate, that improves the incentives of the foreign spouse. She has to understand that she can't just take a free ride. If the marriage dissolves, she has to make a serious job search. On the other hand, that relaxes the incentive of the American spouse to screen the foreign spouse prospect carefully. And then, if you deny the right to mitigation, you reduce the incentive of the foreign spouse to be scrupulous about deciding to marry an American. But on the other hand, you make the American spouse more careful because he knows he may end up with this endless obligation if the marriage goes bad and there won't be anything he can do about it. So how do we decide between those?
Well, I think what we need to do is look at those two sets of incentives, because I think that's right. Those are we need to look at the two sets of incentives and see how they best effectuate federal policy.
I'm sorry, I just missed your word. What are we looking at?
There are two sets of incentives that you've identified.
Two sets of incentives.
Right, there's the incentives for the spouse.
Okay.
And I think before we go into that, I think it's important to note that an affidavit of support does not only apply to an immigrant spouse. While that's the case here, it applies to if and I believe I'm correct on this point, it applies to all family-based immigrants and then also other sets of immigrants who are likely to become a public mm-hmm. charge. So it's broader in scope than that.
Mm-hmm. Now,
and I think that's significant when we talk about the incentives. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, I'm sorry. The word necessary doesn't appear in the statute, but it does appear in that form I 864 that Moon signed. So here's my question. What deference do we have to give the agency that drafted that form? In other words, was that drafting meant only to allow an offset for whatever income the alien had, or was that meant to impose a duty to mitigate?
Well, I think that the form, the way the I-864 form is written with that necessary language, is just designed to offset any income that the alien is making. For example, it would have offset Ms. Liu's support payments from Mr. Mund when he was making support payments. It would offset any income that she earned. I don't think it's clear that establishes a duty to mitigate. And in fact, I think it might actually be the opposite. The fact that in the current version of the form, which I realize is not the one he signed, it's on SA 16.
But the word necessary is sort of pregnant, is it? I mean, if she can work, then it's not necessary that he support her.
Well, is that what necessary means, or does necessary mean to get her up to the 125% of the federal poverty level? Because I take it everybody agrees that other sources of funds she has, whether they be loans from her family, whether they be her own earnings, whatever, are subtracted from the signer of the affidavit's obligation.
And I think that's the correct reading, because the full quote in context is that the sponsor is obligated to, quote, provide the intending immigrant any support necessary to maintain him or her at 125% of the federal poverty guidelines, and that's on SA 16.
So necessary to maintain.
It's not clear that it's necessary to maintain if the other person has a potential source of income, namely going out and working.
I mean, I think it's certainly true that this part of the form is not a model of clarity in drafting. But I think that it's certainly amenable to both readings.
Why is it called? Why is there all this talk about contract? I'm puzzled by that. Why isn't this form 864 just a regulation? Why don't we talk about a contract?
I mean, the reason I think that we talk about a contract is that the 864 affidavit itself identifies itself as a contract.
But I mean, why? Why doesn't it just say you have to support the spouse even if you're divorced? Why don't you say that?
I mean, that would certainly be an easier, and you put an easier case in front of us, but I'm stuck with what the form says.
But Mr. Dickerson, I want to get back to the incentives because, you know, as Judge Posner points out, there are competing ways that you can look at the incentives, and there's, of course, the further problem that this duty to mitigate damages would be something that would be expensive for the public fisc to the extent that people are simply defaulting over to public sources of aid. And I guess my question has been, by promising only support up to 125% of the poverty level, which I gather is $13,000 and some dollars, perhaps has that amount been set so low that the incentive to go find a job exists anyway?
I mean, I think that's correct, Your Honors. In any instance where you could make more than $13,000, I think most people have a desire to do so. It's a very small amount of money, and as this case shows, actually receiving it may result in the attempt to receive it might result in a fairly substantial amount of litigation burden, which Ms. Liu has undertaken.
Sure, and I mean, I'm just thinking, you know, that amount of money in most places in this country is only enough to allow one to live at an extremely modest level, if at all, without other people's help.
I think that's absolutely correct, Your Honor. I think it's important when we talk about the incentives to look at the two potential cases that the incentives set up. Under the current regime, assuming that there's not a duty to mitigate, the regime says the immigration regime creates an incentive to bring in people who are going to look for work, because if you bring in someone who never makes an effort, you're going to be on the hook for 125% of the federal poverty line. And the sponsor, the one who's making that decision, is the person who presumably best knows the alien, certainly better than a federal immigration officer who might be in a position to make that decision, which means they should at least have a reasonable idea of the alien's willingness, ability, and interest in working. And so under a system with no duty to mitigate, the incentives are only to bring in people who are looking for work. I think if you add a duty to mitigate, it actually reverses those incentives. Because now the only time you're going to have to bear the burden of paying for someone is when they come to the United States, they diligently seek employment, and then they fail to find it. If you bring in someone under a duty to mitigate who's never going to work, you as a sponsor are off the hook. They're not going to mitigate. You don't have to pay. If they find a job, you as a sponsor are off the hook. They found employment. You don't have to pay.
But theoretically, you might have to pay if the government pursued you, because isn't there an ability on the part of the government, if it's paying welfare benefits to such a person, to go back to the signer of the affidavit?
Yes, that is in the statute. I found no reported cases in which the government has gone after anyone for support under this statute, and that makes sense if you're the government. It's, you know, the amount involved that either the federal government or a state government are paying are probably relatively small amounts, certainly compared to the cost of detailing a U.S. attorney or a state's attorney to go out and collect this money, especially now with budget cuts in both the state and federal governments.
Well, it certainly seems like the perfect example of the burden on the federal courts of overseeing support of an alien if we allow failure to mitigate as a defense, seems to me.
I mean, and I think that's definitely right. And if you look at this case, it's a good illustration of how high that burden can be. There were two summary judgment motions. There were a number of attorneys, and then there were a number of pro se parties. There was a full day of evidentiary hearing. And I don't think that this would be abnormal under a duty to mitigate regime. And not only would it not be abnormal,
except it's remarkable how little litigation there is.
It's true. There is not a ton of litigation on this issue. Now,
on the other hand, a court of appeals decision might
get
people thinking.
Right. And I think that there's a concern that the fact that the law is unclear may actually deter people from litigating. It's expensive, I think, for the sponsor to go to court to try and contest. So I think that's a real concern. I see I'm in my rebuttal time.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lewis?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Brooke Lewis, and I represent the appellee, Timothy Mund.
Could I start you right off, because there's not a lot of time. I know it's sort of mean, but
absolutely.
There are exactly five circumstances in the statute itself that relieve the sponsor of the obligation to pay, and the alien's failure to mitigate is not one of them. So what I've been thinking about is this. Why should we import federal common law into this truly highly regulated field to create defenses that are not part of the statute?
Well, it's sort of twofold, Your Honor. First of all, I believe that is true. It is not one of those things that gets rid of the liability. But there are two issues. There's the liability issue and there's the damages issue. And I think that the cases that have looked at this issue have been, although they haven't really gotten to the issue because they did find that the individuals had mitigated their damages, they did seem to make a distinction there between the actual liability of, in this case, Mr. Mund, versus the damages.
A variant of Judge Rosen's question. What is the federal interest here? Well, why does the federal government want to have a duty of mitigation? What does it do for it?
Because this is, although, as you stated earlier, it would be more simple if it wasn't a contract, the form itself does state that it is a contract between Mr. Mund and the federal government with Ms. Lou as a third-party beneficiary.
That I don't understand. Do you have any idea why it just isn't a simple regulation imposing requirements on sponsors of foreigners, foreign spouses?
Well, one could assume that they wanted contract law to apply to it if they wanted to call it a contract.
Why? What's the federal interest? I don't understand.
You know, I think that the federal interest is in making sure that the individuals become participatory members of society.
Your system would in many ways defeat that, because it would impose the risk of loss of somebody who fails to look diligently for a job on the federal government, or for that matter the state and local governments, not on the sponsor of the person. And so as long as somebody's willing to live in abject poverty, they are in the United States. They're lawful permanent residents. We'll assume they're not violating any other laws. And under your system, the government now has some perpetual duty to support them,
right,
as opposed to the sponsor.
Except that the government doesn't have a perpetual duty to support them, because they can seek redress from Mr. Mund if they choose to do
so. But how often will the court have to revisit whether she's making a reasonable effort to find work? In other words, would the court have to make an ongoing assessment of the economy, the jobs that are available in the economy, the alien's language skills? Would the alien be required to get job training other than language training? Does the court have to revisit this whole issue every time Mr. Mund feels she's not making an adequate effort? I mean, as I said earlier, I think this case is the perfect example of the burden on the federal courts of overseeing support of an alien if we agree with you.
Frankly, Your Honor, I think that you had a discussion earlier with Mr. Dickerson about, he said that if you ruled on it, then it would be more clear so people might come to court. Frankly, I think that if you ruled that someone had to search for work, in the record of this case, I think it's clear that she wasn't searching for work.
Let's just assume that's right, though. But now let's take the next person who's over in China, a U.S. citizen who's married a Chinese citizen, and they're deciding whether to come to the United States. So they sign this I-864 affidavit with abandon, knowing that they're probably not going to have to worry too much about support, because the person has to... they've got to learn English. I mean, this was held against her, that she wasn't taking advantage of local classes. They're going to have to make a different kind of job search. And I'm assuming she doesn't. So if the person doesn't do it, then it's cost-free to the one who signed the affidavit.
I do think that when people sign the affidavit, they're not expecting to get divorced. They're not expecting to have to deal with the support. So I think that it's not... it's not really an incentive for someone to come into this country to...
Well, the divorce doesn't matter. As Mr. Dickerson pointed out, it could be a child, it could be, you know, some other qualifying family member. But what the signer of the affidavit is promising is to be the backup in case that person can't support themselves.
Exactly, exactly what I'm saying, Your Honor, that they're doing it in case the person can't support themselves.
And
in
that
this
will
case,
often be true, and it's an empty promise if they don't, if there's this duty to find a job on the part of somebody who, you know, is in a foreign country and maybe doesn't, I mean, honestly, reading the transcript with Ms. Liu, her
spoken English is very poor, isn't it?
I believe that it has improved over the time period, but...
It was pretty awful in the transcript.
it's really hard to find a job in the United States if you don't speak intelligible English.
It is, but walking into businesses that aren't hiring is a sure way to assume that you're not going to get a job.
Go to a Chinese restaurant or something.
Well, there are...
I asked you. So apparently the Wisconsin rule... is, you know, you have to interview or try to interview four times a month or something.
I believe
now,
that was
on
what
your
the
view, would this duty
said,
of mitigation
yes.
be governed by state law? Would there be a federal principle?
I believe that the contract law itself is governed by federal law because it is a federal contract.
No, but there's no real federal contract law. So what would it do? Would it adopt the four a month, or would it incorporate local state laws as federal, which often federal common law just incorporates state law? So would this be state by state?
As to the job search in particular, as to the interpretation of the contract?
Duty to mitigate. Interpretation of this form 94.
As to the duty to mitigate, it's my understanding that all states have a duty to mitigate in
general. They don't
general
have the same rule. They don't define the duty the same way. They don't all require four visits a month to four interviews or four applications.
That particular bit was through the divorce court. It was not through her duty to mitigate this contract. That was
but
the divorce
serious
court.
Question is what's enough? Suppose she had done three searches a month, or suppose she had done seven, or suppose some federal judge thought actually you should really do twice a week. You know, I mean, what's enough?
I think it is a fact-based question, and I think it does have something to do with her education and her experience and her ability to get work as well as look for work.
So is your perception that the divorce court is going to be interpreting 894?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Where will they get their... If federal common law determines the duty of mitigation, doesn't that mean that the divorce court has to apply federal common law of mitigation?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. The divorce court was not ruling on this affidavit at all. It specifically, in fact, said that it was not considering this affidavit.
But that might have been a mistake. You know, I mean, so going forward, if this is all interrelated, then surely at least thinking about it. I mean, the divorce court, for example, couldn't require something in conflict with federal law, could it?
No, Your Honor, but it could not enforce the federal contract. And I believe that if...
That's a strange view, by the way, since the backdrop rule is that there's concurrent jurisdiction between the federal courts and state courts.
So he goes into... if he argues in federal court, in state, in the divorce proceeding, that... she has an obligation to find a job or look for a job, and that should govern his financial obligation to her. Doesn't the divorce judge have to interpret 894, decide what kind of mitigation effort she has to make as a matter of federal common law?
He certainly could have. I don't think that that's
though. I don't understand. If the duty of mitigation is created by federal law, doesn't the divorce judge have to interpret and apply federal law?
I think that the divorce court in this case left that up to a federal judge and was
that mean that there have to be that when there's a divorce, there has to be a separate federal proceeding for the mitigation? I mean, the mitigation is a defense to whatever it's his defense to whatever financial benefits she's seeking in the divorce. So can he plead that defense in the divorce court? Does he have to bring a separate suit against her in federal court?
I think that she has to bring a separate suit against him in order to enforce the affidavit. And
where is she even going to find a lawyer to do this?
She did have a couple different lawyers in the initial proceedings before she fired them all.
This is the first of these cases.
It's not, though, Your Honor. There are a few other cases on point, though they weren't in front of the Seventh Circuit. In all of those cases,
she has to bring a separate suit in which she pleads that she adequately mitigated?
Absolutely not. No, she has to bring a suit to...
Two suits.
She has to bring a suit to enforce the affidavit. It's his duty to bring it up as an affirmative defense.
Divorce proceeding. That's where the financial obligations of spouses are determined.
And other contracts are routinely looked at by divorce courts. If there were a contract to sell your car, if there were a contract to do any number of things, run a business, I don't know why divorce courts can't look at contracts.
And again, Your Honor, I think that the divorce court could have, but they chose not to. But that's not the issue that was appealed. It was appealed in front of the federal judge's interpretation of this contract.
Before you sit down, I want to ask you something. Would you like to withdraw your argument regarding how to characterize the $10,000 payment? Because you didn't file a cross appeal, and then how would the issue be before us?
I would actually like to address that, if I may. I know that I'm out of time a little, but the two cases, El Paso Natural Gas and Young Radiator Co., don't actually apply to this current issue. Both of them attempted to bring up issues that were not in front of the court. I think in this case, although Mr. Dickerson has not brought up those issues, Ms. Liu's briefs are, at her request, a part of the record, and Ms. Liu requested in her notice of appeal and in her briefs, to whatever extent you might want to interpret those briefs, that $10,000 payment be given back to her as her own payment and that none of it be applied to her payments.
But the problem for you, especially under the recent decision in Greenlaw, is that we review judgments, not everything that goes along.
Right.
And you would like to expand the judgment that was finally entered in your favor. And that's something you cannot do unless you file a cross appeal. You want to be better for you by $5,000.
In Coe versus County of Cook, it was a father suing the hospital and the mother, I believe, for a rights to prevent the abortion of his supposed unborn child. In that case, the court stated that Judge Flom, I believe, stated that the hardline rule regarding the necessity of cross appeals to ought be abandoned in this circuit.
The Supreme Court later said in Greenlaw that wasn't the way it works. And so whatever we may think has to yield.
But as to the purpose behind the rule was that the appellant is notified of what the appellee wants to argue, and in this case it was brought up in the briefs and it was responded to by Ms. Liu's briefs, although again Mr. Dickerson did not bring them up in his briefs.
One final question. In formulating the position of the federal government, did the Justice Department consult DHS?
I don't know, Your Honor. I spoke only with I can't remember his name off the top of my head. I spoke only with the amicus for the United States once briefly for him to tell me that he was filing his brief. I didn't speak to him at all about the content of his brief.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Lewis, Mr. Dickerson, you have anything further?
I'll try and be brief. I think the jurisdictional cross-appeal question was addressed well enough, so I'll actually just want to talk about an issue that I think all three of you identified in Ms. Lewis's argument, which is that obviously states have different duty to mitigate principles, and if we apply a federal common law duty to mitigate, there's not a clear principle that applies. And I think that that's especially significant in the immigration context, because here you have a complex statutory scheme that is also within the plenary power of Congress to regulate. It's not an area where common law has traditionally been applied, so there's not kind of the evolution of, you know, hundreds of years of state precedents that you might expect in a typical contract case. The fact that this is an immigration matter, I think, should give us pause before we just kind of apply common law without really considering its effects on the policy at issue. If there's nothing further, thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and we thank you, Mr. Dickerson, for your amicus curiae participation, and we thank Mr. Lewis for the government's amicus curiae. And the case will be taken under advisement. The report will be in recess.